Can't Say That is a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. Join your hosts, Drs. Nama Carlin and Melanie White, in a journey to make the familiar unfamiliar.
We are You Can't Say That, a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. I'm Nama Carlin.
And I'm Melanie White.
Nice to see you again, Melanie.
Oh, it's great to see you too, Nama.
I'm very excited for this week.
Me too. This week, we're going to be considering the French philosopher Henri Bergson. We'll just call him Bergson. We'll anglicize his name.
Henry.
Henry Bergson. That's right.
Sounds like a nice guy.
Yeah. Well, do you know, he was a contemporary of Durkheim's, actually. And so Durkheim was in the year ahead of Bergson at the École Normale Supérieure. Anyone who actually speaks French out there will have a heart attack with my accent, and I apologize.
Bergson is one of your main theorists that you work with. Mm. Do you feel like doing a gossip corner to talk about Bergson and the time that he was writing, and I guess his general milieu, other than Durkheim, who we established was a bossy pants?
Yeah, that's right. I think actually, interestingly enough, I think this was the reason why Bergson and Durkheim actually didn't really care for one another. It was precisely because Bergson identified Durkheim as a bossy pants. And so
really?
Apparently in class at the ANS, Bergson often made fun of Durkheim. Bergson actually, I have just found him to be such an interesting thinker. And I first came to Bergson reading his Two Sources of Morality and Religion, which was published in 1932. And that book was the last book that Bergson wrote. And Bergson, I should say, was born in 1859 and died in 1941. And that particular book was his kind of reflection and identification after a long career of trying to come to terms with the limits and possibilities of the human species and the promise of humanity. And it was when I encountered that book for the first time, I remember reading the first 10 pages and I turned away and said, oh my God, he's referencing Durkheim. Now, of course, keeping in mind that he is a French philosopher, a French thinker, and so such references actually are figurative rather than literal, I realized that there was a deep, resonating, but really subterranean debate going on with Durkheim. And so it was that acknowledgement, that moment of recognition that introduced for me a really promising and rich research area that has really been quite enriching, and I've had a lot of fun with it.
Isn't it interesting, though, when you think of the last big pieces that these thinkers write? So with Bergson, it's the Two Sources of Morality. With Durkheim, the dualism of human condition.
Elementary forms of religious life.
Again, that morality, society, Freud, civilization, its discontents. That big opus on what civilization is, what is it turning to, the very nature of our humanity?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that they are all three of those thinkers at, you know, as their sort of the end point of their lives, trying to come to terms with just how rotten we as a species can be, and how to make sense of that, and how to challenge and create a different path based on the promise of our humanity. I realize, Nama, you had asked for some gossip reflections, and I did not provide you with that, but I will now.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So I have it under great authority, and I believe this great authority is actually the New York Times, that when Bergson first came to New York, he was invited to give a speech. And it's often very difficult for us in today's day and age to have a sense of a philosopher as a true celebrity. Mm-hmm. And Bergson was an incredible celebrity. It was the case that Bergson caused the first traffic jam in New York because all of the society ladies were rushing across the streets trying to get to the lecture hall in time to see the grand professor speak. And I always think that that's very exciting because, you know, I have to say, I do not think that that would actually be the case now that
people would be rushing to...
Yeah, or even causing a traffic jam on the streets to go see their favorite philosopher speak. So
interesting. Also, considering that this is in the U.S. and Bergson was writing in France, so I just imagine... that nature of translation as well, of text, and just that migration of knowledge from across continents.
Bergson's mother was English, actually, and so he was an English speaker, and it was the case, actually, that he was quite heavily involved in his in the English translations of his work. And in terms of his connection to the U.S., I think it was in 1917, he was invited by the American president, Woodrow Wilson, to serve as an envoy between France and the U.S. in order to resolve the First World War.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so, I mean, he's got quite a storied political life as well as being the life of the philosopher. And throughout the 1920s, he worked very closely to establish the precursor of UNESCO and was a fundamental founder of the League of Nations. And so he was someone who tried to, at the same time that he recognized the limits of the human species, our violence, our aggression, all the rest, that he saw a fundamental promise and a fundamental hope that if that things were different, that it could be possible to develop a different way of thinking and approaching. I love him. He's his writing is absolutely beautiful.
It is.
And and such an incredibly thoughtful person. It's interesting. I find in reading these various thinkers that when I read him, he makes me happy. And, you know, there are many people, I think, reading Nietzsche, for instance, he makes me angry. You know, Marx, you know, there's a certain affective relationship where...
Absolutely.
And Bergson, somehow, I just feel so content, even when he's talking about desperately awful things.
We have an excellent episode then ahead.
We've got this guy Bergson who could contribute to our thinking in any number of different ways, but we're thinking about him with respect to how does he help us conceptualize the self.
Yeah. When we've talked about the final question that these theorists all come to at the end, you know, in the end, it comes down to the very core of our humanity, our nature as human beings, our species, ourselves. So Bergson has a very interesting take on this, and the idea of becoming is the theme in his one of the themes in his work that we'll focus on. But we also saw this with Durkheim, where a sense of becoming is linked to society and social expectations, experiences, education. Effectively, for Durkheim, becoming part of society is through the process of constant learning and engaging. De Waal, which we discussed previously, looks at becoming through empathy, the evolutionary nature of what makes us human and what distinguishes us or links us with other species. It's a capacity for empathy and sympathy and care. We have Bergson today, and do you want to explain Bergson's link of becoming?
I think a good starting point would be to consider his work in creative evolution. And that was his kind of standout. That's ultimately what made him famous, made him the celebrity. Interestingly, it's taken a bit of time for me to remember some of the goss, but when he spoke in France and Paris, it's interesting. He was very famous, but he was also maligned quite a bit. And he was maligned by the old guard French philosophers who took issue with the fact that his work was often taken up by a popular audience, specifically the society ladies who would come to the lecture halls hearing him speak. But they made such a noise with their crinolines and their silks and their gowns and the that was Melanie.
Good impression.
Yes, that all of the rustling made it very difficult for everyone to hear him speak. So anyway, that was a sidebar.
I like that.
So around the time of this publication, Creative Evolution, I think it's important to think about what Bergson's trying to accomplish.
Okay.
And his number one insight in all of his texts is the fact that we have an experience of time. We try and attempt to think time, but we cannot actually think time. And so in that...
I just blew right by that.
I'm like, yeah, okay, let's take that. But I think I think you're right, that you're paused there. You're like, okay, Melanie, hold up. I think it's important to reflect on it.
Yeah, so the idea of not being able to think time, time is something that we exist with, follow, but yet when you need to think about time or think outside of yourself into time, there you have to make some sort of leap there because time always already passes. Mm-hmm. In what sense can you be within that moment? The minute you start thinking about it, you start rationalizing, intellectualizing, and that moment kind of slips away. What are our experiences of time? You know, they can be so different.
Well, you know, I think when we try to account for time, we say, oh, I'll be there in 5 minutes.
Or never.
Yeah, oh, never. And Melanie's 5 minutes are like, multiply that by three. Certainly we have these mechanisms. You know, we think about, okay, let's count time. Let's rationalize time. We can think about it in terms of seconds, minutes, hours, days.
Yes.
And that's very functional and very useful. It's a technique that allows us to navigate the world and to account for the passage of time. But Bergson's deep insight is that time happens. Time changes. Time changes us. And it happens in the sense that it does something. It's a force in the world. And so if we were to, for instance, stay perfectly silent in this podcast, assuming, of course, that we would have listeners out there that would bear with us and listen while we were perfectly silent.
Radio silence.
Exactly. Time would pass.
Very slowly.
Things would change. We would have a different sense of transformation. Our hearts still beat. Our lungs still inflate and deflate with air. Our skin and our cells grow and decompose and decay. And if we sat stationary, eventually we would die. Stuff happens. And that's a reflection of time. And so in this particular text, Creative Evolution, what Melanie. In this text, Creative Evolution, what Bergson observes is that life is essentially equivalent to time, that there's something about the experience of living that is irreducible to seconds, months, minutes, days, years, that in fact the way that we account and record time is simply a mechanism by which we can aid and facilitate our activities on Earth. I think it's important also to think about Bergson as an utmost philosopher.
Yep.
He do you remember when we talked about Descartes?
Of course.
Do you remember Descartes' questions?
Of course I remember Descartes' questions. He asked about questions of existence. What is existence? What is the nature of knowledge? What is the nature of reality? What can we know? What is there absolute knowledge and what is it?
Well, do you know what?
Mm.
Descartes, like Bergson,
yeah,
are the consummate philosophers. Mm. Those questions are, in fact, Bergson's questions. But, of course, the answers that they propose are completely different.
Hmm. Okay, so we start with the question of what do we know?
Hmm. And it's kind of interesting now that we've mentioned Descartes, because you'll recall, you know, Descartes poses the question, what can we know?
Yeah.
And
who is this I that speaks? What does it mean to be an I that exists in the world?
Hmm. And his answer is,
I am,
so long as I am thinking.
Yeah.
You know, this is the assured foundation of knowledge. And so Bergson's interesting because in the text that I mentioned in Creative Evolution, he starts out and he says, ah, hello, Descartes, my old friend. You have posited the fact that I think, therefore I am, the assured foundation of existence is the I, the self, so long as one is thinking.
That's the answer that Descartes gives.
That's right. And so Bergson says, hey, let's take that as our starting point.
Fantastic.
This existence of which we are so assured and which we know best, okay, let's take it. And we have to take it seriously. And let's use this as our starting point because we can assume it and take it for granted. He says, okay, well, what do we find? What do we find when we think I exist?
Well, we have no proof that other things exist in the world.
And so then, rather than focus his attention on the I, Bergson focuses his attention on the exist. What does it mean to exist?
I feel like that's a dun-dun-dun moment.
Dun-dun-dun! And so
that's the big question.
And so I think Bergson's coming at it from the perspective of one of the major problems in philosophy from his position is the fact that when we think about our concepts that seek to capture something of our reality, they are inevitably inadequate to the task, fundamentally because we cannot think time, and concepts are abstractions or rationalizations of a complex empirical reality. And so we can use a word like a second or a minute, but that word, that concept, is somehow inadequate to the task of really being able to capture the passage of the fulsome reality of time and life. And so what Bergson's upset about basically is that in thinking about concepts like the I, the self, or like existence, the challenge is that we can never really give that concept necessary degree of precision for it to be an absolute form of knowledge or point to an absolute form of knowledge.
What does exist mean to you? What is it like to exist?
I guess it's an I am here.
A presence.
It is a presence and a present, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you pose that because in the present, which is now, it's already past.
Yeah. That's the nature of time. As soon as you have it, it's gone. So it's constant sense of change. So even in existence, to be here and present, that doesn't really mean anything.
Well, that's it. Like you can never, I guess it's that you can never really capture, like it just escapes your grasp.
Yeah.
Like to say, okay, what is this moment right now? It's gone. Let's try that again. 3, 2, 1, gone. Ultimately, I suppose that for Bergson, this is his big complaint in any kind of philosophical system, is that we're really good at coming up with concepts that capture one aspect or facet of knowledge, but specifically when they're related to lived experience, they miss out a fundamental quality of life.
If we can't think time, how can we think existence? But there still is a sense of temporality to being in the world. Well, how does Bergson resolve this? So what does he come up with?
Bergson will look at any given concept and separate out its qualities. And so he will identify, for instance, the quality that is knowable by virtue of the intellect. So with respect to time, we might have a conceptualization of time that is pure repetition, you know, second. But then there is the other component of it, that is the experience of time, the experience that is irreducible to any concrete expression or abstraction or word that attempts to encapsulate the whole full quality of time. So in that context, then we might be able to say that there is a difference between the actual experience of time versus something that is the virtual quality of what escapes that kind of capture, what escapes the capture of the actual.
What I'm hearing from you is then for Bergson, the intellect or the way that we think or reason the world prevents us from being able to think about just how life is messy.
And the experience of it, have you ever had that feeling of something happening to you and you're trying to articulate all of the nuances and you just can't, and you say you had to be there? That feeling that somehow language escapes our capacity to render the messy, crazy, tangled up phenomena of what actually happened.
Yes.
I mean, Bergson, I think, is quite lovely in the way that he articulates that, in the sense that he diagnoses the problem as a problem of the intellect, that somehow the intellect cannot articulate that verbally through language because it, not because it's somehow inadequate, or, you know, we can't find the right word, or that the word is there. Rather, it's that it is simply unable to do this. And that is to think life, to think the living. That is not something that the intellect or our language or our habits have any capacity to be able to do.
That's a big statement for a philosopher, especially, to say that the intellect cannot think life. I mean, isn't this what philosophers do? This is their bread and butter, to think life, to think existence.
Yeah, well, and I think it is, so it's that sense of this experience that fundamentally escapes the capture of these words. So our thought is useful and it's important, and it, in its purely logical form, Bergson will say it cannot capture the true spirit or nature of life, its full meaning, but rather, you know, it can capture something of it, but not the full qualitative dimension of it. Really, Bergson is wondering in this particular text, which is examining the evolutionary theories of thinkers such as Darwin or Lamarck, trying to come to terms with the fact that, well, here we've got an evolutionary problem. If we look at the evolution of species, and we have human beings who have this highly developed, highly rational capability, how is it possible then that we're using this capacity to think in order to explain life, when life is in effect the outcome of a whole evolutionary movement? It's a very fancy way of putting the egg before the chicken.
What came first, society or sociologists? The capacity of the intellect to understand life basically is restricted by the fact that, or preconditioned by the fact that, life itself is the condition for the intellect. And so, yeah, it's a very provocative problem. What does it mean then to have life? If our intellect is not enough to talk about the messiness of the human experience, what is the meaning of it all?
Well, I think that for Bergson, there's that sense in which we can rationalize time and we can think ahead to all of these moments in our lives. We can anticipate, for instance, the fact that we will die. We can abstractly understand that, but the very experience somehow is something that we can't know. There's something not knowable as yet about the fact of what it is to die. We can know in a way, yes, we can anticipate death, but it's that kind of experience that somehow he's pointing to, that somehow our concepts actually can't really explain or capture fully. One of the ways that he reflects on this question of what life is, well, so how do we explain what time is? Time is both, on the one hand, that it is amenable to calculation. You know, there's this mechanical dimension to it. But then on the other hand, there is this element of experience, of enduring, of being able to enter the flow of things. It's kind of like when, I don't know, do you meditate, Nama?
Sometimes.
I'm desperately awful with meditating, but meditating, sometimes time can just escape you, or you're no longer fully cognizant of the passage of time. And that
it also happens when you're drunk.
That is actually true. Here I was, and it also happens when you're knitting. Nama brings it right back down, and it happens when you're drunk. Okay. We live in different ratings of the universe. I'm PGG.
It's not that our rationale or our intellect is what defines us. It's that the fact that I change. Life essence is extended to all life.
Well, that's right. So if we think about this sense of existence, as you say, the very fact of existence being something that is organized through time, but also escapes that organization, it means that all living things, plants, bees, wasps, as you say, amoeba, are all somehow existing. And so when we think of all somehow existing, they exist.
Yeah.
And so what is it then to exist? It is to endure. And so
I like that.
And if we're thinking then about, well, what does this mean for the self? It means that our conventional, if we're thinking back to Descartes, that sense of I am, I exist, so long as I am thinking. What Bergson, I think, does so masterfully is to expose the limits of thought. Limits of thought in terms of the fact that it's not strictly a human capacity. And it's also the case that simply by virtue of the fact that one exists, one is therefore, using the terms of Descartes' contribution, therefore we must open up this sense of the I am, I exist. And that's a function of being a living being. So if one is a living being, one is existing because one is a living being, being in time. One exists in time.
I love the idea that we exist. I think if we're using the cogito, so it would be for Bergson, then I am, I exist, I endure. It's that always becoming, right? But this endurance, it's survival.
One of the things that Bergson says is that one of the things that characterizes life is this sense of striving to overcome a problem. Life has certain needs. I mean, certainly we can think about those in terms of survival, etc. But life succeeds in a way. To live is to succeed and to overcome problems.
That's like Jurassic Park. Life finds a way.
Exactly, it does. Do you know, actually, I watched Jurassic Park recently. And
it holds up. It's good.
Oh, it's amazing. And Jeff Goldblum says that. And I'm like, hallelujah. There is a Bergsonian moment right there in that film.
Yep.
And life does find a way. And it finds a way to overcome obstacles and problems, and that's a function of that kind of striving and enduring quality that, you know, I've been using this language of escaping capture, but that striving and enduring is a reflection of that escaping capture. It's overcoming the capture. And so life does find a way. And if it doesn't, it dies.
It's a very interesting way of thinking and experiencing the world. When you try and think about just being in the world, being in life, it's very interesting because I think we're so used to thinking ahead, thinking through time, thinking through our next appointments, our next meetings, where we need to go. And when you just stop and try and be present for a moment, it feels different in your body. It's this embodied sense where, as you say, there is always change. Something always happens. Cells will rejuvenate, or will. There's a sense of it's always continuing, happening. It's just feels strange to be that weirdness of being.
I think it's trying to wrestle with what we can capture and what is opaque to us. And, you know, I think of Bergson and that just, you know, so what animates that first part of creative evolution is that sense of the challenge to Descartes' cogito, which is, you know, actually there are any myriad ways we could say I think, therefore I am is perhaps too simplistic a premise to build our knowledge upon. But Bergson is coming at it from the point of view that even being able to lay claim to the conception of an I mm-hmm. is itself problematic, because to lay claim to an I means that there is somehow something quite concrete or evident, that it's here now, it's tangible. But one of the qualities of Bergson's insight about the nature of enduring and overcoming is that it is always changing, that there is a fundamental quality of change. So the I is never stable, and in fact is ultimately quite imaginary. Here's something fantastic that Bergson says with respect to the I. He has this marvelous moment where he says, okay, you know, if we look to our attention and we look to the way in which our attention to ourselves identifies these artificial moments in life. Oh, you know, before this meeting or after the next one, or the lunch before the podcast, or the tea after the podcast. It feels like everything is united by this artificial bond, that artificial bond being a Melanie. Ah, I'm going to go do this, or I'm going to go do that. And one of the things that Bergson wants to challenge is that sense of this formless, indifferent, unchangeable, fixed entity that feeds together, strings together all of these different moments, much as if one would string together the different moments or beads on a necklace. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to challenge that idea that there is something fixed about our sense of who we are, or what we are, or how we define ourselves, and trying to really draw our attention to the fact that there is a fundamentally changeable dimension of our experience. And he says, and I'm just going to quote this line because it's lovely. He says, "For an ego which does not change, does not endure, and a psychic state which remains the same so long as it is not replaced by the following state does not endure either." And if we are to define for Bergson what the self is or what the I is, it would necessarily need to be defined by this quality of endurance or this overcoming, which is to say that there is fundamental transformation happening all the time, whether or not we're aware of it.
Mm. I like that. I think it's also about overcoming the fact that you can't ever know your I. So it's always that overcoming, in the sense that to have an I, to say an I, you need to have a knowledge of what it is, but also that separation from it, right? Mm. It's kind of that you need to be away from the very thing that you need to define. And you can't when it comes to defining and saying, I exist. Well, who is this I that speaks? It's incredible. Mm. I think that sense of endurance is to constantly need to reflect as well, and to live a life knowing that there's no point where you're just standing still. And once you stand still, he says, you know, he said before, an ego that does not change does not endure. And endurance is life. You're setting yourself outside of life in that sense as well. Maybe not outside of life.
Yeah, well, it's almost like, you know, you're presuming that it would be possible to step out of life.
Yeah.
And this is the nature of our knowledge practices, yeah, or the way that we conceptualize, is as if we stand outside ourselves and can come up with these concepts that seek to describe this reality, but the concepts are always inadequate to the task. They can never do it. And so this is what Bergson is pointing out, is that there's a fundamental difference in kind between what we think we can account for and a reality that is life in time. And that life in time is a quality of endurance and overcoming and fundamental, continuous, permanent change. And when we're thinking about what that change is, it's not like, ooh, I'm just changing with the wind. Rather, it is a change that means that you become different to yourself, different to whatever it was you were in the moment or second or nanosecond beforehand.
I don't know about you, but I feel like today's conversation has really made me think differently and feel differently about myself and my relation with the world. I think I will walk out of the studio and I will notice things have changed.
I will too. You know what? You know what I've realized?
Yeah.
I've changed. My clothes are the same, but I've changed.
Absolutely. So thank you for this chat this week.
Thanks, Nama. It's always great.
Did you want to add anything else?
I have a quote.
Yep.
A final quote from Bergson. He says, "Our personality shoots, grows, and ripens without ceasing. Each of its moments is something new, added to what was before. We may go further. It is not only something new, but something unforeseeable." Bergson is the man who says, "Hey, Melanie White, you cannot control outcomes. You cannot predict your future. You cannot know." And so there's something about being open to the world, and that changes one's relationship to the world.
That is beautiful.
Isn't it marvelous?
It is. And I'm walking out of here being open to the world and with endurance and zeal.
I like the word zeal. It is to be zealous with life. Zeal is related to zest.
Oh, nice.
Yes, I think so. I think it is, actually.
Let's invite our listeners to fact check us. And if not, they can shout at us on Twitter.
Oh, I was going to fact check, but you're right. We should engage our listeners.
Yeah.
Fact check.
Yep.
Zest and zeal.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a lovely morning, day, evening,
night, whatever time.
Year.
Yeah.
And know all the while that
you are changing, enduring, life is happening.
Indeed.
I need you to, you're next to the computer.
Oh. Oops.
It's the wrong one. Oh. Hello, Descartes, my old friend.
Hello, Descartes.
I can't sing at all.
Hello, Descartes, my old friend.
Bonus episode.
You can't say that. It's a Colin White collaboration. Francesca Renucci.